Exodus chapter 33. We are one chapter removed from the idolatry of the nation of Israel. And Moses has been up on Mount Sinai for 40 days. He was just a few days shy of coming down and sharing with the nation the revelation that he received about the Lord and the instructions that the Lord gave him up there on Mount Sinai. But as you know, the nation couldn't wait. They just couldn't be patient for those last couple of days. And they decided, well, let's just move on and let's just do our own thing. So Moses was up there getting divine revelation to learn about God. But the people below were using human imagination to create their own God. Now, as you know, we are made in God's own image, and yet we are warned and we are given commandments that as mankind created in God's own image, here's what we're not allowed to do. We're not allowed to create God in mankind's own image. We're not allowed to just make stuff up. But that's what the nation has done. You kind of want to give them a little bit of credit because you know their motives were in a good place. They wanted to know about the Lord. That's a good thing. And we know that they even went so far as to take some of the stuff that they knew about the Lord and incorporate that into their worship. And we want to kind of find good in there. We want to say, well, good job on that. But the only problem is that what they ended up with wasn't God. And if you get any aspect of that wrong, you're not serving God. You've created God in your own image. So what they do backfires regardless of where their motivations were. Regardless of perhaps some good in there, it's tough to see because it backfired on them, and now we're at the stage where the Lord has to set punishment for the nation of Israel. And that brings us to chapter 33. Chapter 33, in order for it to make sense, there's a few things you need to understand. You need to understand that there is some overlap between chapter 32 and chapter 33, especially when we take a look at the last two verses of chapter 32, verses 34 and 35. What those two verses are, well, it's essentially a summary of what we're going to cover in Exodus chapter 33 tonight. We've been given the summary statements in advance, so we know what's going to happen, but now we get chapter 33, which is going to give us the in-depth breakdown, the details of those summary statements in verse 34 and 35 of chapter 32. It's the same thing that the Lord did with the creation of mankind. If you remember from our Genesis studies, I know that was a long time ago, but Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, the Lord gave us the same thing. He gave us a two-verse summary of the creation of mankind. But then we dip over into chapter 2, Genesis chapter 2, and what the Lord gives us in chapter 2 is then a detailed breakdown of that two-verse summary. So in Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, you have the summary statement, you have the wide-angle lens. And then when you get to chapter 2, Genesis 2, you get the same account, only this time you get the zoom lens. You get the detail. So that's the difference between Exodus chapter 32, verses 34 and 35. That's the wide-angle lens. Now we're in Exodus chapter 33. We're looking at it with a zoom lens. So as of the beginning of chapter 33, here's what we have to do. We have to pretend like we don't know what's going to happen. We do know what's going to happen. We got the summary, but we got to pretend like we don't know what's going to happen. We got to act as though we don't know what the Lord is going to do from this point out. The nation has grieved his heart. God is in the process of deciding, I don't know if I'm done with the nation. I might be done. God is in the process of deciding on their fate, their punishment. All of that is very much up to grabs in Exodus chapter 33, and that's how we approach it. It is an in-depth story of life after the golden calf. The people had bowed the knee to the golden calf, and the Lord had a beef with that. And so now what? That's the big question, and that's what Exodus 33 is going to answer for us. So let's take a look in verse 1. Let's begin reading. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Depart and go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt, to the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying," and now I want us to stop right there for a moment, because unfortunately, this is where things get complicated. Everything that we've read so far in verse 1, that is God speaking to Moses afresh. This is new direction for Moses. But now, as we continue on in verse 1, the Lord is going to quote himself. So this is God speaking. He's giving a fresh word, but in that conversation, the Lord quotes himself. He reaches back to a previous statement that he made. It was a promise to the nation of Israel. And because of that, we have something important that we have to get in place. First of all, whatever the Lord says in these first couple of verses, we need that to be in quotation marks. But then, because God is quoting himself, we also need inner quotation marks within those outer quotation marks. Now, in proper English style, this is called a nested quotation. All right, so outer quotation, this is everything that God is saying. Inner quotation, in order to contain the quote that God is giving us. And unfortunately, what makes this complicated is that our New King James Version translators got those nested quotations wrong. Don't bother looking at the King James Version. They don't even try. There's no quotation marks at all. The New King James Version translators, they tried, and props to them, props to those translators, for at least understanding that there needs to be outer quotations and a nested quotation, and props to them for starting that nested quotation in the right place. But woe is us, because unfortunately, they did us wrong, and they stopped. They closed the nested quotation way too early in the statement. And because of that, they resume God's fresh and new conversation with Moses way, way too early. So, this may not sound all that exciting to you, but I want you to know that it is extremely important. Believe me, it is important, because if we don't get these nested quotation marks correct, we will not be able to correctly interpret this chapter. And I'll show you that in a minute. You have to have these nested quotations correct in order to be doctrinally correct as you move through the chapter. So I'm going to read this to you, and I want you to listen carefully to what I do with the quotation marks. First of all, God began speaking in verse 1 with the word depart. So we have an open quotation mark. They got that one in the right place. Next, as we continue on in verse 1, we come to God's quote of himself. So there needs to be a nested quotation, and there it is. What do you know? Okay, they've got that in the right place. So now listen very carefully to me as I read on, continuing there in verse 1. Here's what the Lord said, quoting himself, "To your descendants I will give it." Now, notice the New King James Version has now closed that nested quotation. I need you to ignore that. If you want, if you don't mind, exit out in your Bible, because it's in the wrong place. That nested quotation continues on in verse 2, so let's read verse 2. "To your descendants I will give it, and I will send my angel before you." That's Jesus. We know that's Jesus. "And I will drive out the Canaanite and the Amorite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite." And now you can close that nested quotation. God is done quoting himself. So everything that we are now going to read, God is still talking. He's not done talking, but he's done quoting himself. So everything that we're going to read now, beginning in verse 3, this is now new, fresh conversation This is now new instruction from the Lord, and let's read it, verse 3. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, for I will not go up in your midst, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people, end quote. That's the end of the whole quote. They're no longer buck-necked, but the Lord says they are still stiff-necked. Okay, I promise that's the last time I use that joke. I'm done with it. Now, here's why the proper placement of those quotation marks is so important. If we leave the quotation marks where our translators put them, then here's what I'd be trying to teach you. I'd be trying to teach you why it is that God said in verse 2 that the angel of the Lord, Jesus, is going to go with them. But verse 3, God says, but I'm not going. That is a doctrinal problem. That is a doctrinal impossibility for the Lord to say, well, I'm mad, so I'm staying behind. I'm done with the nation. But we drew straws. Jesus, the Son, he drew the short straw, so he's going to go. But I'm done. God the Father, done. But God the Son, he'll go. Now, you know, church, that is an impossibility. Jesus told us in John chapter 10, verse 30, I and my Father are one. Jesus told the disciples that, hey, I'm doing the work that my Father's doing. Whatever my Father's doing, that's what I'm doing. Why? We're inseparable. The Father and the Son are one. We quoted it, I think, Sunday. If you've seen me, Jesus said, you've seen the Father. So that's one proof that we've done the right thing with the quotation marks here. We've ignored the temptations thrown down by the New King James Version translators, and we've placed the quotations in the right place. Now, apart from that, we know that the nested quote should extend all the way to the end of verse 2. And you know how we know that? Because that's the whole promise. That's the promise that the Lord gave to the nation. He said every time he gave this promise and every time he referred back to this promise, it always contained these two elements. Number one, I'm giving you the land of Canaan as your possession. Number two, I'm going with you and I'm going to be your God. So I would give you as references quite a few passages, actually. It can be found in Genesis chapter 17. It can be found in Exodus 3, Exodus 6, Exodus 23, and of course, once again here in Exodus 33. So Exodus 33, verses 1 through 3, you get me, don't you? This is not Jesus and the Father parting ways, all right? This is what this is. This is God threatening to change the terms of the covenant, the original covenant. Let me put this to you in as plain a speech as I can. In verses 1 through 3, God is saying, I forgive the nation of their idolatry. I made a promise to them that they can have the land of Canaan as their possession, as their land. I'm going to honor that, but I have also promised to go with the nation and be their God and lead them through, you know, boots on the ground, the angel of the Lord. But the Lord is saying, on that aspect of it, that part of the covenant, that part of the agreement, I've changed my mind and I'm not going. I'm done with the nation. You still get the land, but you don't get the God of the land anymore. God is saying, I am out. So, the understanding that we have established just now is what causes the rest of this chapter to be able to make sense. If you don't get that part correct, then you're going to spend the whole chapter going back and forth and saying, okay, verse 2, okay, the Lord is going. Wait, verse 3, wait, no, the Lord is not going. A few verses later, maybe he is going. Maybe just Jesus is going. I don't know. By the time you get to the end of it, you're going to be like, I give up. I don't know what the Lord is saying. I can't tell if he's going with the nation or not, or if he's disowned them. I'm just thoroughly confused. But because we now have our setup correct for the chapter, the rest of the chapter can make sense. And here's what it is. The rest of the chapter is Moses interceding for the nation. Remember, this is a work that the Lord is doing in the heart of Moses. The rest of the chapter is this. It's Moses interceding for the nation and trying his best to get God to back down from the threat that he has leveled in verse 3. This is Moses trying to talk God into not changing the terms of the covenant. This is Moses trying to get God to honor that original agreement and remain the God of the nation. Verse 4. And when the people heard this bad news, they mourned, and no one put on his ornaments. Verse 5. For the Lord had said to Moses, say to the children of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. I could come up into your midst in one moment and consume you. Now, therefore, take off your ornaments that I may know what to do with you. Verse 6. So the children of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments by Mount Horeb. To be sure, the Lord certainly already knew how he was going to punish them. That's what we're waiting on in verses 4 through 6. And though the Lord has no doubt already determined how to punish the nation, what he does in verses 4 through 6 is he makes them sweat it out. He wants to give them time to really think about it. He wants to make sure that they really learn the lesson. So, you know, it's like the child in the corner. You go wait in the corner. Don't move. Don't say a word until I decide how to punish you. Something's coming. Punishment is coming. Grounding is coming. Go to your room. I don't know how it was when you were a kid, but those two times when I was bad as a kid, it was the couch. You go sit on the couch. Don't you move. Don't you touch the TV. Don't you get off that couch. Don't you say a word until I decide how to punish you. That was my thing. And that's what the nation of Israel is getting. You just give me space. Give me time. A punishment is coming. And boy, you're going to get it. Now, what does Israel know here at this point? They know that they're still getting the land. And from what they've heard, from what they've been told, they know that God is not going with them. They know that they're on their own. And they know that punishment is coming. But they don't know what that punishment is yet. But of course, we already know because we found out in advance, again, in Exodus chapter 32, verse 35. We found that out in advance. We know that the punishment is going to be a plague upon the nation. They don't know that yet. Now, I mentioned last week that the reason why the Lord told them to take off their jewelry, it wasn't maybe what you're thinking. It's not because jewelry is a sin. And I made those points, and I kind of said that I would pass that off to this week. I told you that I would go into greater detail this week, but the truth is, I think I covered it adequately enough. It's a thing that pastors do. They say they're not going to say something, and then they just go all into it, and they cover it anyway. That's kind of what I did last week. So if you have any questions about why the nation is told to take off their jewelry here, I'm going to encourage you to go back and listen to last Wednesday night's teaching, and I'll just let you cover that on your own because we did cover it in good detail. But for now, let's move on to verse 7. It says, Moses took his tent and pitched it outside the camp, far from the camp, and called it the Tabernacle of Meeting. And it came to pass that everyone who sought the Lord went out to the Tabernacle of Meeting, which was outside the camp. Now, just a quick question for you. We have studied the instructions of God to Moses for the tabernacle, the sanctuary of God, the place where worship for the nation would take place. Does anyone remember what the Lord called that? He called it the Tabernacle of Meeting. All right? He called it the Tabernacle of Meeting. So look at verse 7. Moses takes his tent, no doubt directed by God. He takes his personal tent, his personal tabernacle, and he moves it far outside the camp. He sets it up far outside the camp. And what does he call it? He calls it the tabernacle of meeting. Why? Well, because God had no sooner gotten the instructions for the tabernacle out of his mouth before the nation already needed one. They needed a tabernacle. They needed a place to worship. They needed a sanctuary, a place where they could meet with the Lord. It was supposed to be in the center of town, but that was before the nation was defiled by this false god and this false worship. So now, because of that defilement, we see the Lord playing hard to get a little bit. We see the Lord exercising tough love. He takes the tent of Moses, the personal dwelling, he moves it outside of the camp, and now he says, okay, makeshift, temporary tabernacle of meeting. Moses' place, this is the temporary sanctuary. So if you have business to do with God, if you want to seek the Lord, if you have a problem that you need fixed or a sin that you need covered, you gotta leave town and you gotta head out to where Moses has set up this temporary tent in order to take the place and satisfy the need of the tabernacle that is coming. It is a solid spiritual truth that God doesn't come into your defilement and coexist with your sins. He doesn't come into you. He doesn't partner up with you and say, yeah, Arlen, I know about that sin, but that's okay. I'm here. It's fine. We'll let it slip. We know that in spiritual truth, the way it works is that God doesn't partner up with us in our sin. The way it works is that we have to leave our sin. We have to leave the defilement. We have to go to where the undefiled God is, and we have to find out our salvation there. There's a New Testament theological term for it. We've been talking about it a good bit here lately. It's the word repentance. That is, you got to turn from this, the defilement. You got to go to where the undefiled God is, and you have to get salvation from him. Now, that's not to say that you have to clean yourself up and rid yourself of sin before you come to the Lord and before he'll save you. That defeats the whole purpose. You don't clean yourself up and get better and rehab yourself so that you can get saved. No, but you know the truth. In your heart, though you can't do it without God's power, in your heart you have to turn away from the defilement. You have to do a 180. You have to direct yourself to the Lord. You have to go to him, and he'll give you the salvation that you're looking for. Verse 8, so it was, whenever Moses went out to the tabernacle, that all the people rose, and each man stood at his tent door and watched Moses until he had gone into the tabernacle. And it came to pass when Moses entered the tabernacle that the pillar of cloud descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle, and the Lord talked with Moses. Verse 10, all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the tabernacle door, and all the people rose and worshiped each man in his tent door. So verse 8, they stand at attention as Moses enters his tent, the temporary sanctuary, the temporary tabernacle, because they know what's about to happen. They know that God is about to decide their punishment. It's a pretty sober moment. Verse 9, they know that whatever Moses says when he comes out, he isn't just making stuff up. It's not Wizard of Oz, and maybe Moses is the man behind the curtain, and he's just kind of pretending that the Lord's speaking, and he's doing his own thing. No, in verse 9, the nation knows for sure that when Moses comes out, whatever he has to say is from the Lord, because they've seen the cloud of God's presence descend onto the tent. Once Moses goes in, the cloud descends on the tent, and it seals off the entrance. It's for sure, visibly, knowably, the Lord and Moses in there working on a negotiation. And so what else can they do? They rise up as Moses enters the tent, and then they worship. Now, in the Hebrew, it literally means to bow down. So I like that. It means Moses walks up to his tent, they all rise up, and then the Lord comes down, and so do they. They hit the deck, they bow the knee, because important stuff is being discussed. They're petrified. Verse 11, so the Lord spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend, and he would return to the camp, but his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, did not depart from the tabernacle. Now that is a peek ahead verse, and it's quite telling. Joshua was allowed to move with Moses and the Lord outside of the encampment. And Moses had a job to do. You know, whenever Moses received a message from God, he was the pastor, so he had to take that message. He had to go into town. He had to leave where the Lord was at the tabernacle, the temporary tabernacle. He had to go in town, and he had to deliver that message. He had to go back and forth. But Joshua, he's just an assistant. That's not his responsibility. So I love Joshua. I love what he does. He never comes into town. He never comes back into the encampment. He stays out there in the tabernacle with the Lord. I think that's brilliant. I think we're starting to see some of the character of Joshua. We're seeing attributes that will eventually make him such a great successor to Moses. He's one of those guys. Moses, that's all right. You go ahead. You go into town. Go do what you have to do. Go do your pastor's work. I'm going to stay here with the Lord. The Lord's here. I'm not budging. I'm going to stay in the tent. He's like the Old Testament version of Mary of Bethany, you know, always at the feet of Jesus, never wanting to budge. There's work to be done, but she's distracted by the words of Jesus. I kind of see Joshua as that same type of person. He's the guy that just doesn't want to budge from the presence of the Lord. Wherever the Lord is, that's where Joshua wants to be. Verse 11 told us that God spoke to Moses face to face. That could also be translated as mouth to mouth, but let's face it, that sounds weird. So our translators stick with face to face. It is a Hebrew expression, and all that means is that there is an open, two-way conversation between God and Moses. It certainly does not mean that Moses is seeing the Lord face to face here. We know that's not true because the chapter goes on to tell us that, of course, Moses isn't seeing the face of God. The rest of the chapter bears that out. Verse 11 then told us that God spoke to Moses as a man speaks to his friend. So it's not two presidents formally and professionally negotiating a peace talk or an agreement or a contract. This is two close friends hashing it out. This is plain speech. In the book of Numbers, and this is in Numbers chapter 12, when there was that whole contesting of the authority of Moses, the Lord spoke to the aggressors there in Numbers chapter 12, verses 6 through 8. And here's what he told. Of course, it was Miriam and Aaron. But here's what the Lord said to them. He said, hear my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream, but not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak with him face to face, even plainly, and not in dark sayings. So the prophets, they got dark sayings, they got veiled words, they got hidden truths, but something was different between God and Moses. Moses got the friend conversation. He got the open conversation. He had that privilege of speaking to the Lord as a person would speak to their friend. I wonder if that's how you speak with God. I'd like to hear your version of that. What do your conversations between you and the Lord sound like? Is it like, you know, presidential negotiations? Is it like, you know, like a person, a criminal would talk to a police officer. It wasn't me. I didn't do it. Honest to goodness, ask anyone. I saw who it was. It wasn't me. It was them. You got the wrong person. Please don't take me away. Is that how you speak to the Lord, as if he's your police officer? Is it formal? Do you speak to the Lord in King James Version? Oh, I love this one. Lord, that thou wouldest hear mine petition and answereth mine prayer. Is that how you speak to the Lord? Like he's a dignitary that you're trying to impress, as if he got stuck in the 1300s and that's still how he talks? Is that how you speak to the Lord? Or do you speak to the Lord like you do your friends? That is, the guard is down. There's nothing fake. The mask comes down. You're not hiding anything. You're not trying to impress anyone, but you recognize God as a friend and you can talk to him that way. Well, that's how Moses had it. And if that's how you have it, you're doing well. Don't lose that. The Lord doesn't want you to be fancy. He doesn't want you to be formal. He certainly doesn't want you to be avoiding your wrong and shading the truth so he doesn't know how bad you are. He just wants you to be you. He wants you to speak openly and honestly to him. And if you'll do that, he'll do the same in exchange for you. Well, verse 12, then Moses said to the Lord, see, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you have also found grace in my sight. Now, verse 12 is a proof that we have this correct in our interpretation tonight. Moses would not have said this otherwise, because God has in the past given him a promise that he would go with him, that he would lead him and that he would lead the nation. So you see, Moses here now is saying essentially, okay, Lord, you're not going with us now. I get it. I understand you told me we now have to go without you, but you didn't tell me who's going to replace you. Someone's got to lead us. I can't lead us. So who's going to replace you? You need to send someone that knows where we're going. Verse 13, now therefore I pray, if I have found grace in your sight, show me now your way, that I may know you, and that I might find grace in your sight, and consider that this nation is your people. So Moses, in this negotiation, has requested three very, very important things in verse 13. First of all, Moses has requested the leadership of God. So again, Lord, you say I found grace in your sight. There's grace in your heart for me. You chose me to do this. You told me in the past you were going to be with us and you were going to lead us. Now there's no one to lead us. So Lord, you at least got to tell me the way. Like maybe give us a third tablet of stone, scratch out a map on it so I know where we're going. Otherwise, we're in trouble because I don't know the way. I don't know how to get there. Secondly, Moses has requested a personal relationship with God. Moses still wanted to know God. You know, Lord, regardless of what you decide about the rest of the nation, I'm going to try to hash that out with you, Lord. I'm going to try to bargain with you. But regardless of what you decide about the rest of the nation, here's the truth of it. I still want to know you. I still want to have a personal relationship with you. And thirdly, and this is awesome, I love this. Thirdly, Moses requests national partnership with God. In essence, Moses has asked that God would reconsider his decision about the nation of Israel. God was threatening to disown the nation, and Moses was asking God, reconsider. Consider the nation to be your people. Lord, take them back. I know you're mad at your people. You're okay with me, and that's great. I know you're mad at your people, but Lord, they are your people. You've committed yourself to them. You gave them your word. So, Lord, consider them your people. Don't divorce them. Don't put them up for adoption. Don't disband them. Don't disown them. Change your mind and take the nation back. That's some powerful intercession there, isn't it? Verse 14, and he, the Lord, said, my presence will go with you, singular, and I will give you, singular, rest. Okay, so God has now entered into negotiation with Moses. And God is still playing hardball here, but he has made a concession. He has conceded something in this negotiation. In verse 3, God said, I'm not going, period. I'm done. And then Moses makes his requests, and now God says, okay, I'll go with you, Moses, just you. I'm still done with the nation, still mad at them. I'm not going to take them back, but I will go with you. I will bless you. I will lead you. There will be peace and rest in your heart, but not the nation. You want to know me? You can know me, Moses, personally, but the rest of the nation cannot. So don't you love this? The Lord is like really dialing up the pressure here and making them sweat it out. God wants to come across as haggling, bargaining, negotiating. But hello, Moses is a Jew. And what are Jews excellent at? What's one of their national traits? What do the Jews excel at? Haggling, bargaining. Now, don't get mad at me, but when I was young, we used to use that expression, Jew them down. Did you ever hear that? Yeah. Now, just bear with me for a minute. Don't get mad at me, but we used to say, you know, like, well, that guy wanted $40 for that, but I Jewed him down to $30. I got a deal. Now, I want to state that at no time did I mean that in a negative way to the Jewish people. And if I did still say it today, I still wouldn't mean it in a negative way. I would mean it as a positive. It's a positive trait. The Jews are excellent at bargaining, and that is a good thing. So because it's no longer politically correct, though, I've had to abandon that expression. I just want to use it one more time tonight. Can I use it one more time? Okay, because here's what Moses has done. Moses, being an excellent Jew, he has Jewed God down. Now, he's not done. He has more bargaining to do because Moses isn't completely content with the agreement. He's making progress. The Lord has conceded a little bit. He's given in a little bit. There's been a compromise, but Moses is not entirely content with the agreement as the Lord has just stated it. So Moses now makes his stand. He's already asked for it, but now Moses is going to make his stand. Watch this. Verse 15, then he said to him, if your presence does not go with us, plural, remember? Verse 14, what did the Lord say? You, I'll go with you, singular. I'll bless you, singular. Moses says, thanks for that. I appreciate that you're promising to go with me. But Lord, if your presence does not go with us, plural, then do not bring us, plural, up from here. Verse 16, for how then will it be known that your people and I have found grace in your sight, except you go with us? So we shall be separate, your people and I. You notice how many times Moses keeps saying, your people, your people, your people, hint, hint, hint. So shall your people and I from all the people who are upon the face of the earth. Okay, I messed that up. Let me try one more time. Time out. Start over. Verse 1. Okay, well, let me try this again. So we shall be separate, your people and I, from all the people who are upon the face of the earth. Lord, you met me in the middle. You said you'd go with me and that you'd give me rest. But God, if your presence doesn't go with us, underline that. Lord, if you're not with all of us, if you don't go with all of us, then I don't think we're even going to bother leaving this spot. We'll just stay here. If you're with me, that's wonderful. Then I'm different. I'm separate. I'm set apart from everyone else. But if you're not with the nation, from the nation's perspective, Lord, there's nothing different. There's nothing unique about the nation. They're just another pagan, godless nation. So, Lord, if you're not going to go with all of us, thank you for the offer, but I'm just going to stay put with the nation. This is as good as a place as any to die without God. Moses here is making great progress as an intercessor for the nation of Israel. He is driving a hard bargain with the Lord, and that takes guts, maybe just a slight tinge of insanity too, but I like what he's doing. It wasn't enough for Moses to have God to himself. He wanted fellowship with God to be a national thing. And that's a beautiful heart in the chest of Moses. And I hope we have the same kind of hearts in our chest that, man, we're so grateful for our salvation. We're so thankful and blessed by what God has done for us, but it's just not good enough for us to keep that to ourselves. We want that relationship with God. We want fellowship with God, not just to be personal and exclusive, but we want it to be for our families and our circle of friends and even for our whole nation. If that heart is in your chest, that has the great makings of an intercessor and a great evangelist. Verse 17. So the Lord said to Moses, I will also do this thing that you have spoken, for you have found grace, unearned, undeserved, unmerited favor. You have found grace in my sight, and I know you by name. Personal favor, Moses. You drive a hard bargain, but I'm in. So check that out. Moses wins the negotiation. Moses came with his terms, and God agreed to all of them. He has, well, I can't say it again. I promise that was the last time. He has beat God at haggling. God has given in. Okay, Moses, I'll do this too. You win. I'll go with the whole nation to the promised land. I'll be the God of the whole nation. They'll be my people again. I'll honor my original agreement, and I won't alter the terms at all. You've talked me into it. And of course, if you were here last week, you know the skinny on this. You know that all of this was God's idea. All of this was God's will. Moses isn't actually, truthfully talking God into anything here. It's not like, you know, God was like, well, Moses, I had planned on just throwing out the nation, just being done with them. But Moses, man, check him out. He's such a good prayer. And then he looked at me with those puppy dog eyes, and I just couldn't tell him no. No, it wasn't Moses convincing God of anything. This was God doing the work in Moses to be an intercessor. This is Moses' moment on the stage to display, to portray that work that God is doing in him. This is God testing him, chapter 32, chapter 3, testing him, and it's Moses passing the test. So here's the results of that negotiation. We know that Moses is where he needs to be with the Lord. He's ready to intercede for this nation. And Moses has been granted every single one of the terms that he brought to that negotiation. But big surprise, guess what? The Lord's will was also done too. So it's a win, win, win for all of them. And now, I mean, when you're on that much of a roll, what do? You go for broke, right? He's hit a single, a double, a triple. Why not go for the home run? He's gone for the home run. He's on a roll. So here's the pitch. Verse 18. And he said to the Lord, one more request now since things are going good. Lord, please show me your glory. Incredible statement, isn't it? Just think about the things that Moses has seen in his short experience with the Lord. He has seen God in the burning bush. He has seen God in the administration of the plagues. You know, I go and speak and I raise my rod or I drop my rod. And Lord, you do the work, miracle after miracle. He's seen God in the cloud by day and fire by night. He's seen God in the manna on the ground every morning to feed them. He's seen God in the rock that gushed water when they were thirsty. He's seen God in the Red Sea parting. He's seen God in the Red Sea closing and swallowing up their enemies. Moses has seen a lot of miracles. He's seen signs and wonders. And yet Moses, almost as if in discontent, he says, "Lord, show me your glory. I want to see who you really are. I've seen you do stuff. I've seen miracles. But Lord, I want to see you in your fullness." And I think that is such a profound request because it proves to be true what I've been teaching in this church from the beginning, from the scriptures, that miracles and signs and wonders, those are acts of God, but they aren't God. They are of God, but they aren't God. And unfortunately, I think people seek signs and wonders and miracles. They seek the miracles of God, but they don't seek the God of the miracles. They're content to just see stuff. I'm not. I never have been. I've never been just content to come to church and see a miracle, and I've seen them. I've never been just content to see God do signs and wonders that I can't explain. That's never been good enough for me. I've always wanted to know God personally. I've always wanted to see God as clearly as he would show himself to me. It reminds me of what the Apostle Paul said there in the book of Romans, I believe, or Philippians. In one of the books that Paul wrote, after having been a Christian for like 30 years or so, having seen some incredible stuff himself, and as Paul is talking about some of the things that he has sacrificed for the Lord and some of the suffering he has done for the Lord, Paul says this incredibly. He says, "Here's what I really want, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection." That might seem, you know, tough to grasp, that we Christians who have been serving the Lord for 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 years, however long it might be, that we would still be at that place where we're praying daily, "Lord, show me who you really are. Let me know you, Lord, like I've never known you before. Reveal yourself to me in all new ways." I think that's a great truth, though. That's a great truth. That if that's where your heart is and you really want to know God on that level, you're never going to be fully content on earth. It's just never going to cut it. I mean, you're going to be satisfied and fulfilled as much as you can be on this earth, but there's eternity in us. There's something that is spiritual within us, something that is of God within us, and that's never going to be contented until we are with him. The psalmist David put it like this in Psalm 17:15. As he's speaking about what contents other people. And he says this about himself. He says, "As for me, I will see your face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake in your likeness." Isn't that the truth? It is wonderful that we can hear, we can learn the heart of God through the Word of God. And we can be filled with the Spirit of God through our praying. But there's always going to be that element that is never going to be fully and truly satisfied until we get the full experience. But the full experience is coming. The day is coming when we are going to get to experience God in his fullness. No more veil, no more blinders, no more, you know, a little bit here and there, but the full glory of God. Verse 19, then he said, "I will make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion." Verse 20, but he said, "You cannot see me face to face, for no man shall see me and live." Or, as that venerable philosopher Meatloaf once said, "I will do anything for love, but I won't do that." Moses, I love you, but that is not going to work. I can't do that. Again, it's not God saying, "Well, I could show you, but then I'd have to kill you." You know, as I've said before, he is God the Father, not the Godfather. This is not a threat. This is a truth. It's just a truth. You guys know that truth well here at Anchored Fellowship. That truth is that the human body just cannot contain the power and the brilliance and the glory of God. We're going to see that in the life of Moses. He's going to get closer than anyone else. And having spent that time in that incredible closeness to God, he's going to come down off the mountain and his face is going to be glowing. And they have to veil his face. It's like the hazmat shield, you know? He's borderline radiation poisoning. He's, I don't know, maybe popping iodine pills to try to handle that. He's glowing from just that closeness. Now imagine if the Lord said, no blinders, eyes wide open, you get to see me exactly as I am. Imagine what would happen. Spontaneous combustion. It would just blow the physical body apart. So it is for our own good that we have to wait for that one. Verse 21, and the Lord said, here is a place by me, and you shall stand on the rock. Verse 22, so it shall be while my glory passes by that I will put you in the cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand while I pass by. Verse 23, then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, or literally, you will see my afterglow, but my face shall not be seen. Isn't the Lord incredibly gracious to Moses? Moses, I can't show you my full glory, but here's what I'll do. I'll give you as much as I can. I'll give you as much as you can handle without the fibers of your body blowing apart. Here's what I'll do. I'll show you a little piece. I'll show you the afterglow. Now, these are anthropomorphisms. We know God really doesn't have a hand. He's not going to stick a big old hand on the mouth of the cave so Moses can't see. And we know God doesn't really have a face. He's not walking by like this. We understand all that. These are anthropomorphisms to help us understand. But unfortunately, they don't help us understand. We have no idea what this was like and what Moses saw. All that we can do is stick with this basic idea that Moses wanted to see God in his fullness. God knew that the flesh of Moses couldn't handle that, but God gave Moses a little taste of his glory. And the only way I can explain it is it's like swimming in the ocean and you got your back to the open ocean and a great, huge, and fast ship blows right by. You don't see it coming because you got your back to it. You don't see it and it just blows right by you and the waves are so immense that they just wash over you and dunk you. And so you pop right back up right away because you want to see what it was. And you turn around and look, and the boat's gone. You don't get to see the ship. And all that you can see is the wake of the ship, the massive wave trail that's leading to where that ship went through, the eddies and the currents and the foam. But that's it. You didn't get to see the ship. And that's what Moses gets here. I think that's what we get to on this earth. I mean, we Christians were blown away by the glory of God that we get to experience in these earthly bodies. Can you imagine what lies ahead for us? Can you imagine the glories that we're going to get to see one day? Remind me again why it is that the Christian would fear death. I can't figure it out. I'm looking forward to seeing the Lord. I'd rather it be in the rapture. But if it's death, that's okay. A little bit of pain and then a whole lot of glory to follow. Would you stand?